IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. You might hear some background noise on my end. Unfortunately, we're also recording from home due to the pandemic. But today we want to talk about China. There was a time perhaps 20 years back when it didn't seem all that foolish to imagine that the Chinese state might move in a more liberal direction. That time is, of course, now long gone. Over more than a decade, and perhaps especially under President Xi Jinping, we've seen the coercive apparatus of the Chinese state make a comeback. And two new papers from the journal China Leadership Monitor give us a sense of how and why that is happening. And to talk about them, today I'm joined by our very own China hands, Manoj Kevalramani and Suyash Desai. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thanks.
Hi, Ajit.
Suyash, I want to start with you. This is a paper discussing China's national security state, and it talks about the drivers of this national security state. Can you tell us more about it?
Yes. So this is a paper written by Professor Thai Minh Chung. He's a very senior professor in University, California University. This is an excerpt, or this is a small portion from his upcoming book, which also deep dives into China as a national security and technology-centric state. In this paper, he argues that there are two ways of identifying a national security state. Through the theoretical prism, one way is through defensive realism, one way is through offensive realism. Defensive realism plus game theory. So in positive sum game, China's action tending towards defensive in nature, not affecting countries outside its borders, fall into the realm of defensive realism. But again, it's turning towards national security. But in a zero-sum game, impacting countries outside its borders fall into the realm of offensive sum game, or fall into the realm of offensive realism, which are impacting countries outside its border. It's called these two criteria coming together fall under the category of national security state. There are different factors that he has identified for locating China into this prism. First and foremost, he says that China started towards the course of turning into a national security state from 2010. From 2002, it was more open to the world, but since Xi became the second in command in CMC, that was the period, that was under whose regime, that was the period when China started moving towards national security state. First, a few indicators that prove that China is moving towards national security state was in the third plenum, was in the communique of the third plenum of the 18th Party Congress in November 2013, when it was announced, when several security-related legislations, laws, and strategies were announced. This was followed by establishment of CNSC, that is Central National Security Commission. These two were the important indicators, followed by reforms within the state and within the armed forces, within the state as in tightening of their hands in Xinjiang, or also the recent actions that have taken place in a national security law that has been implemented in Hong Kong, and then the PLA reforms. All of this coming together establish a picture of China turning into a security state. Now the paper identifies what were the motives behind China turning into a security state. There are two streams of looking at it. One is the dangers from outside, and second one is the motivation of China doing something in the future by becoming a national. So national security state being means to achieve a larger end. Dangers being the cliched one that China has talked over a long time for many years. Invasion from outside, color revolution, That's number one. Point number two, undermining of reforms that were being carried out for so many years. Implied logic behind is this is that, especially under whose regime, at the later end of whose regime, these reforms were diluted and were not implemented properly. And third and the most important one, interruption in China's socialist system, also implying threat to the Communist Party of Communist Chinese Communist Party. These were the reforms that pushed China towards becoming a security state. Now, what pulled China towards becoming a security state? After Xi coming to power, the article mentions that the realization of China becoming the center of the world, or China walking towards the greatness, one, due to the structural factors because of the relative decline of West, and two, due to the steep rise of China itself or East. This was a pulling factor for China to go towards national security state. There are other factors that paper talks about, but broadly, these were the factors that China under Xi realized for becoming a national security state. Now, what are the symptoms of becoming a national security state? One, there is a lot of discipline enforcement campaign that takes place. This discipline enforcement campaign can be internally as well as externally, more so internally. And we have already seen this in Xinjiang, Hong Kong. Second point, there is a crackdown on political opposition, which is happening since 2013. Manoj maybe can talk about other fields, but I can also say that a lot of crackdown has happened in the People's Liberation Army. That's number two. And three, a lot of aggression takes place in the near periphery or outside factors that are outside China's periphery. And that we have seen in case of coercive attitude or more aggression in case of China, China Sea, Taiwan, Japan. All these things coming to life, militarization of island. These are the symptoms of becoming domestic and international symptoms of a country becoming into national security state. There is also a vital element of technology. The use of technology, especially from 2013-14. This is not in this article, but more broadly his arguments and upcoming hypothesis for his book. Use of extensive technology in implementing this measures, especially in Xinjiang and probably in Hong Kong. Manoj and Rohan, our colleagues, have also written a paper about use of technology in Hong Kong. So use of technology to assert the power or assert these security measures is also an important factor in identifying security state. So these are all the factors, symptoms, drivers for China under Xi, especially from 2010, becoming a security state. This is what the paper broadly argued.
Okay, the paper does use the term national security fortress, and it cites, like you said, Hong Kong, COVID-19 also, and US-China relations. Is there anything specific in US-China relations that impinges directly on China's internal security?
Yes, the part where it talks about the color revolution. So it's been, they have said this repeatedly, the external interference could lead to color revolutions. Not that harsh language, I am paraphrasing it. But he has given Western interference as a logic, or deteriorating of US-China relation as a logic for one of the reasons for China moving into a national security state system to protect color revolutions or to avoid internal dissatisfaction to come over. These were the broad tenets on which US-China relations came in this paper.
I just wanted to sort of add to what Suresh was saying. So some of this is like, you know, I mean, if you go back and look at the timeline of how this has evolved, I think the idea of a national security state that he's talking about is essentially about security becoming the sense of insecurity and the need for security becoming the prime factor in policy making across the board, whether it was with regards to innovation, whether it was with regards to, you know, ideological control, whether it's with regards to corruption. Everything began to be seen increasingly from an existential security threat point of view. And that then fed into the nature of policies which the party state adopted, which then has, as a consequence, you've seen, has amplified the sort of discord that existed between the US and China. Today, when the US says that, today when the US starts to raise objections about Made in China 2025, their argument is essentially like this is driven from a perspective of, securitization, from a perspective of dominating these technologies so that you can compete. And from a Chinese point of view, it's driven from the perspective of, well, what if we get cut off? What are the challenges that we have, And you can see how both those events and both those thought processes have actually played out in the real world today, where, the US is using supply chains and its dominance of technology supply chains as a pressure point on China. And the Chinese are sort of also doing exactly what their sense of insecurity has led them to do, which is do things like the party enforcing its writ on the private sector even more than it had in the past. The sort of so-called liberal era of the early 2000s is completely gone. So I think that's how essentially this as an ideology sort of plays out. The other aspect of all of this is, like Suyash said, right, this threat of color revolutions in that business. I mean, if you go back to the early 2000s, you saw the US launch this war on terrorism, which essentially was sort of invading countries in the name of democracy promotion, effectively. That's what happened in Iraq eventually. And then you had the Arab Spring. And just before the Arab Spring, you had two serious protest movements within China. One was in 2008 in Tibet, just before the Beijing Olympics. One was in the subsequent year in Xinjiang, which led sort of riots in Urumqi. And the sense was about this pushback that's taking place ideologically against the party. And you need to sort of crack down. Now, when Xi Jinping comes to power, he essentially looks at this and he says, look, I need to turn in a direction which is different from where we are right now. And he does multiple things that Suyash has talked about to sort of implement that policy, from an ideological crackdown to an anti-corruption crackdown. Just to give you a sense of the scale of the anti-corruption crackdown, which has been to deal with corruption along with political opponents. Since 2012 to 2019, nearly 3 million party members have been punished under the anti-corruption crackdown. That's a significant percentage. That's a little over 3% of the entire party. So that just tells you about the scope of what this has been. And it's continuing. It's not stopping. In fact, in the last couple of years, there's been more people punished than before. And this will continue. So I think the sense is that this is how both these forces, this anxiety and insecurity with regard to the US, reinforce China's turn towards a far more sort of security-driven paradigm. And as China moved towards a far more security-driven paradigm, the US continued to push further because it felt that the policy of engagement, like we see today, wasn't working. China was turning far more coercive, far more inward. The other aspect in the paper that he talks about is about while this existed and this anxiety and these dangers existed in the minds of the Chinese leaders, I mean, he gives it this term, right? It's called the three major dangers. There were also these so-called three unprecedenteds, which presented an opportunity. What were these unprecedenteds? They were essentially, the fact that China was rising and it was moving closer to the center of world affairs. The second was that China was approaching the goal of this great rejuvenation of the country, which is essentially about how it was about to eliminate poverty and it was moving in a positive direction. Its economic might was increasing. And the third was about how it had more capability because of all of this development to actually achieve, its great power ambitions in some way. And that, again, as you become more securitized, you also see dangers, but you see new opportunities because of the newfound power. And you are then pushing towards those opportunities, which further lead to a backlash and reinforce those other insecurities that you have. We saw this in the South China Sea. So I think it's an interesting paradigm in terms of how leaders perceive the world, what policies they take, and what sort of biases, what sort of concerns, what sort of opportunities get reinforced. And those then lead a chain of events. So I think that's one of the most sort of interesting things. The last part of the paper, which I thought was really fascinating, is when he talks about, okay, you've created this entire new architecture with all these institutions, with everything. And Xi Jinping sits atop of all this. What happens when he goes? Because sooner or later, he's human. He will go. And what is that transition going to be like? And that's the sort of, in one way, the big challenge that lies before Beijing.
So Manoj, you did talk about the anti-corruption drive, and that brings us to this second paper, which talks about something I had no idea about, I'll admit, which is this crackdown on underworld forces. I had no idea that China still had underworld forces and that there were protection umbrellas. what is driven this? Is it entirely connected to the anti-corruption drive, or is there something else going on?
So this is an interesting sort of, I was aware of the campaign, but not in the detail that the paper sort of talks about. And it links to what's happening currently also, and I'll get to that. So this paper is by Sheena Grettens. It's a really well done paper, which talks about this campaign, which began in January 2018, and which is just culminated. Over this period of time, it ends formally in 2021. So it's a 3-year campaign, but bulk of it's sort of done. What it basically did was that the objective was to look at these underworld forces, so underworld criminal gangs. And there are lots of criminal gangs in China. In fact, actually, if you read about crime in China, it's really fascinating. You will have places where essentially small towns are essentially run by gang rape in some ways. And why is that possible is because local party leaders are in cahoots with these underworld gangs, which is what the paper calls protection umbrellas. And the objective was to deal with this sort of gang rule, because it's obviously a social stability, security issue. But also it's an issue of corruption and the creation of these cliques at local levels, which have become big enough, can create major problems. And also, of course, fundamentally about dealing with public dissatisfaction, because there's a point at which people will also start pushing back if you're not providing them what is basically their basic need of security. So it was multi-pronged: to deal with corruption, to deal with public security and public issues, and to also deal with sort of taking out your political opponents. It serves multiple purposes. Like I said, it was launched in January 2018. And since then, there's been sort of multiple steps taken, the figures, if you read through the paper, are really interesting, because what you'll find out is that you can't have one authoritative figure of how many people have been prosecuted under the campaign, how many people have been detained. Yet in different reports that you will find, whether it's from the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, or from the National Leading Group on the campaign, you'll find different figures of how many people were taken down, which provinces were targeted, how much money was seized, what kind of crimes were sort of addressed. And essentially, much of this is essentially about these three things: dealing with political corruption, dealing with genuine sort of public security issues, and sort of issues of how business can be done without any external influence or criminal influence. And thirdly, also about taking down your political opponents. To me, why this is really interesting is not in itself for the campaign, that these things exist and the party central leadership is very worried about these so-called protection umbrellas at the local level, but also because it leads to this broader idea of centralized control in China. This year, ever since COVID hit, earlier this year, actually, the Chinese government was talking about, in January, I think Xi Jinping had mentioned about launching a rectification and education campaign of the legal apparatus. The legal apparatus essentially covers your Supreme People's Court, the People's Procuratorate, the investigators. It covers your police and sort of associated security apparatus, not the PLA or the People's Armed Police. And the objective was that there was essentially a need to make sure that these groups of people, these systems, fall in line with the central leadership's authority. So therefore, this is where the sort of business of cracking down on underworld gangs and protection umbrellas of the party that support these, because that can't be done without police support, links to broader rectification campaign, which links to political stability and support for Xi Jinping. So when COVID started, one of the first sort of big people to be taken down in the security apparatus was the Vice Minister for Public Security. He's a central leader. His name is Sun Lijun. He was being investigated for so-called suspected discipline violations. And that was the beginning of what we have seen as evolving as a rectification campaign. And to me, that's interesting, because this is going to go on till October this year. And then subsequently, it will be launched over the next couple of years. From 2021, it will be launched nationally, ending in early 2022, which is fascinating, because by the end of 2022, you're going to see the 20th Party Congress, which is when all this jostling will come up about whether Xi Jinping gets a third term as the party's general secretary. This rectification campaign currently that's underway is on a trial basis. It's across select parts of the country. It's led by a gentleman called Chen Yixin, who is the deputy at the Central Political and Legal Affairs Commission of the party, which essentially controls your large parts of the legal apparatus. And he's a Xi Jinping loyalist. And he, when he launched this campaign, he spoke about something called finding, you know, taking, there are four tasks that he outlined. And this is how it connects to the earlier paper that I was talking about. He talks about cracking down on protection umbrellas. He talks about cracking down on two-faced people who are disloyal and dishonest to the party. He talks about improving law enforcement, promoting heroes and role models, and the creation of a quote-unquote political police, which firmly implements the two upholds or the two safeguards, which mean the authority of the party and the authority of Xi Jinping. And what was fascinating about this was that when he was launching this, he spoke about something. He invoked the 1940s Yan'an rectification movement, which was essentially the movement that led to Mao Zedong emerging as the prominent leader, as sort of the, you know, above all else in the Communist Party, and Mao Zedong thought being a doctor. So I think it's interesting in terms of how this is developing. There is a genuine sort of criminal security angle to all of this, but there is also deeply political angle to all of this. And her paper documents campaign, the earlier campaign, the Sao Hei campaign, which talks up and covers how this then eventually will link into the rectification campaign. And I think it's an interesting view.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really struck by how in both papers, there doesn't seem to be any clear boundary between protecting Xi Jinping and his acolytes and, you know, achieving these broader objectives. But I, you know, I'm really fascinated by this paper on the underworld because I had no idea about it. How much does this affect China overseas? You know, is there a connection, for example, to Chinese investments, to maybe even Belt and Road? She does talk about the so-called Skynet 2019 operation, a fairly unfortunately named operation, which involves the so-called repatriation of people using Interpol red notices. Is there an impact of this underworld and these protection umbrellas overseas?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there is eventually, right? He talks about not just the Skynet, but also this thing of a clean Belt and Road, right? She talks about how this process of getting people back through channels using the Interpol and issuing red corner notices has played out over the last couple of years as part of this campaign. So essentially what happens is that a lot of the money that comes in, a lot of these deals that are done, and this is why I believe that, you know, a lot of the argument about BRI being centrally driven and controlled are a little bit, they stand a little bit on weak ground. Because yes, there's a lot of central control, but a lot of this also happens organically with different interest groups across the country at local levels, seeing opportunities. And what happens is that a lot of times these private businesses or party-linked entities end up signing deals with foreign enterprises. Some of these deals might be extremely shady. Some of the money sort of gets laundered abroad and it goes into accounts of these local party guys. Particularly in the context of Hong Kong, you'll hear a lot of this about, you know, Chinese party money there. But it's not just there, it's also in other parts of the world. So part of this crackdown entails, therefore, this sort of foreign aspect. And under this campaign, according to her paper, about 2,000 people, 2,000 expatriates have been sort of brought back, which is significant, right? 40 of those individuals were brought back after Interpol notices were issued. 860 of these are party members or government officials. And the amount that she talks about is 5.4 billion RMB in stolen assets being recovered. And more of this is going to happen in this year. It's already happening in this year and will happen a little bit over the next year also. So I think there is a foreign component of this. The Chinese, particularly under Xi Jinping, had this fox hunt campaign where they were looking at party members, officials who sort of fled the country, and how do you try to get different people back to the country? And this has become a political goal. And it's all linked to corruption at different levels of the party state system, which also then ties in to the factional conflicts, because you pick up the corruption of the people who are inconvenient to you as opposed to the people who are from your faction. So therefore, it all sort of ties in together at the end of the day to the politics of it, which, like you said, is about preserving Xi Jinping's authority.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated by how much I don't know about China. Every time you these papers come up or I get to talk to both of you. Thank you so much, Manoj and Suyash. It's been a really fascinating episode.
And thank you for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.